We have become a nation of hand washers. I didn't say hand wringers. Hand washers. Something new in the last few years. And that is that you can find hand sanitizers everywhere. If you go on a cruise, they'll have hand sanitizers every 5 feet. If you go into some public places, maybe a restaurant or a theater or something like that, an airport, they're going to have automatic hand sanitizers all over the place. And it's very common for them now to be in restrooms in various places, rest areas or gas stations, that sort of thing. Although I have to tell you, and I don't want to be indiscreet, but what good does it do to have a hand sanitizer in a room that so reeks of germs that you're afraid to touch the hand sanitizer? Or a sanitizer that doesn't have anything in it. You're just hitting it and there's no soap or sanitizing agent in there. But we become very aware of germs and the danger of contracting sickness by contact with our hands. And frankly, I'm not making fun of those who wash their hands frequently. That's a wise thing to do, and particularly during the time of year when there's a lot of sickness going around. We're shaking hands and we're touching things that others have touched, and then we're touching our face or, you know, putting our fingers in our mouth if you're, you know, less than 14 or 15. And so it's very easy for us to contact the germs of others. How many of you really are uncomfortable going to a buffet anymore, a buffet restaurant? Really? Raise them up high. I'm just curious. Okay, now reach over and touch your neighbor with your hand. Those are germ factories. Have you thought about that? When I go into, and I love Chinese food, I love Chinese buffets, and there are some good buffets in the area, but it's a mixed bag because I go there because I like the food, I want to enjoy it, but all I can think about is this ladle that I have in my hand has been touched by who knows how many people, and I don't know what they have or what they've been touching, and then I'm going to eat with my hand some of the food that I put on my plate, and then I'm going to go and touch the ladle again, and other people are doing the same thing. That'll ruin a Chinese meal for you. I'll just tell you that. But what's happened is we've just become more sensitive to the need to be careful about the transmission of germs. And that's especially true because there are some superbugs that are now starting to become more prolific that don't respond to some of the medications that were commonly used, antibiotics commonly used to treat those kinds of things in the past. How many of you women carry hand sanitizers in your purse? Raise your hand. See, now that doesn't... Okay, all of you men who raise your hands, let me say that again. We're just cautious. Well, it just shows that we're concerned about cleanliness. The Pharisees of Jesus' day were likewise very concerned about cleanliness, particularly ceremonial cleanness. And as was read in Mark the 7th chapter, we're going to talk about some of their criticism of Jesus' disciples. The Pharisees were exceedingly careful to avoid touching anything that was considered unclean, anybody who was considered unclean. Do you remember the story of Simon the Pharisee who invites Jesus apparently over for a meal, and while Jesus is there in Simon's home, in comes a woman and she is showing her reverence for the Lord, and Simon is thinking in his mind, if he were a prophet, he wouldn't let this woman touch him because she's a sinner. She's unclean. And no Pharisee wanted to be touching anything or anybody that was unclean, lest he himself become unclean. So they were very concerned about ceremonial cleanness. They paid special attention to the washing of their hands, but for a little different reason than what I've been suggesting thus far. But this concern for cleanness led to some criticism of Jesus' disciples. And we're going to be looking at Mark, the 7th chapter this evening. That same story is recorded over in Matthew, the 15th chapter. But we're going to look at Mark's account this evening. And we're going to notice the criticism and then Jesus' response to the criticism. Then some comments that are made later by Jesus and the surprise of the disciples. And we'll talk a little bit about a couple of applications that we need to make based on this particular story. So let's begin with the criticism that was leveled against Jesus' disciples by the Pharisees. Now, if you saw that very quickly, it said, criticism of disciples, Mark 7, 1 through 5. This thing's only deciding to work when it wants to work. The first five verses essentially constitute the passage that deals with the criticism. Now, I know we read them together with Dave just a few moments ago, but I'd like to read them once again. I'm reading from the English Standard Version. Now, when the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, Jerusalem was the center of orthodoxy in Jesus' day. If you were going to find some really assiduous law keepers, they would be in Judea. They'd be in the south and probably in Jerusalem. And so these had come from Jerusalem. They saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. For the Pharisees, now Mark's explaining what the controversy is about, what the criticism stems from to a Gentile audience. He's explaining things that might not have been apparent. Matthew doesn't do that as much. His explanation is much more brief because he's writing to a Jewish audience who would have known what the problem that the Pharisees and the scribes had with Jesus' disciples. So Mark explains in verse 3, "For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. And the Pharisees and scribes asked him," that is Jesus, "why do your disciples not walk according to the traditions of the elders, but eat with defiled hands?" And so the Pharisees are concerned because the disciples are eating with defiled, that is, unwashed hands. Now, it's probable, I don't know this for sure, it's probable that the disciples had in fact eaten their hands. They had in fact washed their hands, but they hadn't done it according to the tradition of the elders. There were specific ways that you were to do that, acceptable ways, so that you could be sure not to be ceremonially unclean. Notice in verse 5, where it says, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders?" So that's what we're dealing with. The elders had certain traditions regarding how hands were to be washed. Now, this is an important point. For the Pharisees, the physical defilement of the disciples' hands, the fact that they were eating with hands that hadn't been washed according to the tradition of the elders, led to spiritual or religious consequences. That's their criticism. Now, Jesus, on occasion, would ask questions of his detractors. Sometimes he didn't defend everything that the disciples were accused of. But on this occasion, Jesus comes out to defend his disciples, beginning in verse 6, and he says to these scribes and Pharisees, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you, hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me.'" The nature of hypocrisy is that it involves a pretense. It's the putting up of a facade, an impression that is actually deceitful. It's intended to mislead. It gives the impression that one is spiritual when in fact one is not. That's one example of it. And he says that they honored God with their lips, but their heart is far from them. The truth is, they're not interested in honoring God. It's all exterior. It's all for show. That's hypocrisy, and Jesus identifies them as hypocrites. "In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. You leave the commandment of God and hold to the tradition of men." And he said to them, "You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition. And now he gives an example of that very thing. For Moses said, honor your father and your mother, one command, and whoever reviles father or mother must surely die, another command. But you say, if a man tells his father or his mother, whatever you would have gained from me is Corban, that is given to God, then you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or mother, thus making void, useless, empty, futile, the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. And many such things you do. And so Jesus labeled them as hypocrites because of their leaving the commandment of God to keep their traditions. That's the specific way in which they honor with their lips, but their heart is far from God. And Jesus gave an example of their hypocrisy. Of course, Mark's explanation of this Corban tradition is fairly easy to understand. The law said I had a responsibility to honor my father and mother, and that would entail helping them with financial needs if that need existed. But what they had done with their tradition was they'd suggested or taught that if I said to my father or my mother, well, whatever I could have helped you with, I've dedicated to the Lord. Now it becomes a matter of priority. I can't take what I've dedicated to the Lord and use it to help my parents. The Lord is more important than my parents. You see the thinking there. But I want you to notice there in verse 5 it is. I'm sorry, not it's actually not verse 5. It is verse... Yeah, I lost my place here. In verse 12... verse 11, he says, but you say, if a man tells his father or his mother, whatever you would have gained from his Corban, that is given to God, then you no longer permit him to do anything. You understand what he's saying? It's not that they were not constrained to do that. In other words, if I say to my parents, it's Corban, I've dedicated it to God, it's not that I'm now not obligated to help them, I'm not allowed to help them. I'm not permitted to honor my father and mother. And Jesus says, what you've done is you've just basically made the commandment of God to honor father and mother useless. You've made it empty and void by your tradition. The practical consequence of their tradition was that they voided the word of God, and then Jesus goes on to express a general principle here in verses 14 and 15. He says, in verse 14, he called the people to him again and said to them, hear me, all of you, and understand. He's been speaking to a crowd. There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of a person are what defile him. Now that's an interesting statement because the Pharisees were concerned about someone becoming defiled, not washing their hands right, and being defiled and eating with defiled hands. But Jesus doesn't just talk about exterior defilement. He takes the next step and says, there's nothing that goes into a man that can defile him. He's defiled by what comes out of a man. Now, that's an interesting thing to say. When the old law said there are certain things you couldn't eat. The old law said there were certain things that were unclean. If you ate those things, what was your condition? You became unclean. You were defiled by what you put into your mouth. I want you to notice the difference between what the ESV says and what the New King James Version says when the disciples ask about this question. In verse 19, in the ESV, Jesus is quoted as saying, since it enters, do you not see verse 18, the end of the verse, that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and is expelled. And then the parenthetical statement, thus he declared all foods clean. That's a comment by Mark, supposedly. At least the translators have taken it that way. Now the New King James Version has a little different translation of that. Both of them are possible translations. You have to decide from the context what's being said here. Verse 19 says, the New King James Version, because it does not enter his heart, but his stomach, and is eliminated, thus purifying all foods. I have to be honest with you. I've never understood the sense in which the digestive process purifies all foods. We know that in our intestines, bacteria breaks down this food. So that translation has never made a lot of sense to me. But if Jesus, in verse 19, is declaring all foods clean, then he's teaching something that's not going to be practiced until later, once the law of Moses has been set aside. Because as long as the law of Moses was in effect, the Jews were obligated to make that distinction between clean and unclean foods. Later on, Paul will say in Romans 14 that all things are acceptable to eat. There's no distinction anymore about clean or unclean foods. The Pharisees were concerned about unwashed hands. Jesus talked about what goes into a man. Now, as you can see from the last slide, the disciples were puzzled by Jesus' comments. In fact, if you go down to verse 17, and when he had entered the house and left the people, so now the crowd is gone, Jesus is just with his smaller group of disciples, his disciples asked him about the parable. And he said to them, verse 18, "Then are you also without understanding?" Jesus seems almost a little surprised that they don't understand his earlier comment. "Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and is expelled?" Thus he declared all foods clean. "And he said, what comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a man." Now, the Pharisees were concerned about ceremonial uncleanness, and so they had made this big issue about washing their hands, the disciples, according to the tradition of the elders. But Jesus now wants to talk about spiritual defilement. And he says that is accomplished by what comes out of a man's heart, not what he puts into his body or puts into his mouth. And Jesus gave a list of sins, not comprehensive by any means, but I think just as examples to show the extent of what the heart is capable of in terms of defiling a man. Notice the sins that he mentions here: sexual immorality, murder, adultery, theft. But he also talks about evil thoughts and slander and envy and pride. Sometimes people classify sins as small or large depending on their temporal consequences. Jesus says there's a whole raft of sins. And as I said, he's not giving a comprehensive list to my understanding. Well, what kind of application should we make of this? Well, I said earlier, I am entirely in favor of hand washing. How many of you would sit down at the table at your home with hands that look like that and said, "I'll have two helpings of spaghetti, please. Here, I'll dip yours"? How many of us would do that? We look at that and we say, "No, that's repulsive. Who would eat with hands that look like that? That's just filthy. That's dirt." But how many people have all kinds of filth inside their hearts when Jesus said what's really important is the interior of man, not this? We would be better off eating with filthy hands like that at the supper table than allowing our hearts to be filled with all kinds of evil, all kinds of filth that in effect defile us, while this may make us sick and it may not be very attractive. But that's just a physical thing. We're talking about spiritual defilement. Now, I wouldn't come to the table like that. If I was working outside, what would you do? You'd go just like I would. You'd go wash your hands, so that your hands are clean before you eat. But I wonder if we're as careful about the condition of our hearts as we are about whether our hands have been sanitized before we put something in our mouth to eat. Isn't that Jesus' point? That the Pharisees were focusing on the exterior, but more important was the interior, the heart of man, because that's where essentially sin originates. That's one of the points I would make out of this whole passage. Jesus is saying that these things, they come out of the heart of man. And notice what he says. He talks about murder. Cain murdered his brother. Text says he hated him first. There's an emotion. The murder began in his heart. The problem with Cain started in his heart long before he killed his brother in the field. Jesus said the man who looks on a woman to lust after her, he's committed adultery with her already in his heart. The adultery starts long before he has sexual relations with a woman to whom he has no right. It starts in the heart. It starts with his thoughts before the overt act is ever committed. And so sin originates in the heart. And by the time the overt act, if in fact we're talking about a sin that involves an overt act, by the time that occurs, we're long down the road of sinfulness. Jesus made some startling comments in Matthew, the 18th chapter, verses 8 and 9. He said, and if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life crippled or lame than with two hands or two feet to be thrown into the eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into the hell of fire. Think about that. In order to avoid sin, cut your hand off. That's the literal meaning of what Jesus said. But now for Mark, the 7th chapter, we understand that that's not at all what he's saying. Can't be, because that wouldn't really stop sin, would it? The sin didn't start here, did it? Started here. The hand only does what the heart tells it to do. The heart in the Bible, of course, is our mind, our thoughts, our intellect, not the blood pump that I've been pointing to every time I say it. And so the hand really isn't the perpetrator of this. It's the heart, the mind of man that directs him to do these things. So cutting off the hand isn't going to make any difference. And so we know this is a figurative way of saying that we need to make whatever sacrifice is necessary in order to avoid sin. Jesus uses a figure that is so vivid that it catches our attention. Can you imagine yanking your eye out and throwing it off to the side of the road? I looked on a woman and I lusted after her, and so I rip out my right eye. Can you imagine that? But what Jesus is saying is, you do what's necessary to avoid hellfire. That's what he's saying. Whatever sacrifice it takes, that's what you and I need to do. That's easy to say. That's much harder to do. Temptation works through the desires of the heart. James said that in the first chapter of James, in verse 13. He said, let no one say when he's tempted, I'm being tempted by God. Not God's fault, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. Well, then whose fault is it? It's my fault if I'm tempted. Each person is tempted when he's lured and enticed by his own desire. Where does that desire begin? In the heart again, heart of man. Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. That's what Jesus is talking about in Matthew 5 when he talks about a man looking on a woman. Looks on her to desire her, to lust after her. He's already given in to his desires. And lust then moves on to the overt action of adultery. But he's already committed adultery with her in his heart from the standpoint that that's where the sin originated. Sin originates in the heart. That's the first thing we ought to look at. And that just suggests the next lesson, and that is, it is absolutely critical that we guard our hearts. You know, the Europeans think we're funny. They think we're germaphobes. We're so concerned about washing and showering every day and washing our hair all the time and making sure we smell nice and putting deodorant on and antiperspirant and all of this. Well, I personally am in favor of some of those things. Someone says, some of those things? Okay, all of those things. But I'm a little concerned that maybe we're a lot more preoccupied about this exterior box that our spirit lives in than we are the condition of our heart. The Pharisees were that way. They were concerned about the cleanliness of their hands, but they failed to see to the cleanliness of their hearts. And Jesus, on another occasion, made that very clear. In Matthew 23, verses 25 and 26, he says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and the plate, that the outside also may be clean." What's he talking about? Cups and plates? He's talking about them. This business of presenting to the world that this appearance of righteousness. You know, everybody in the church thinks I'm really pure, thinks I'm holy, thinks I'm a good teacher, thinks I'm faithful to my wife, when in fact I'm looking at other women. That's the idea that he's talking about. He's talking about people who are looking at reputation, who are looking at the appearance, when in fact they are filled with filthiness. Jesus said, you're cleaning the wrong thing. You're worried about the exterior. You need to be taking care of the interior. He uses another illustration, the very next two verses, same kind of illustration. Very vivid as well. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you're like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. So you also outwardly appear righteous to others, but within you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. This illustration is the same concept as the earlier one, but it gets more specific, doesn't it? He compares them to those tombs that the Jews would whitewash in the vicinity of Jerusalem, when the pilgrims would come for the annual festivals, so that those who were unfamiliar with the area, perhaps coming from other areas and coming to observe the feast, would not accidentally become ceremonially unclean by contacting a tomb that had corruption inside, had a dead body in their bones. So they'd whitewash them so that it was very apparent that was a source of corruption. You need to go around that. Don't rest and lean your back up against the stone that covers the mouth of the tomb. But Jesus says, you Pharisees, you're exactly like that. On the outside, you look all good and righteous. But on the inside, look, he says, you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. What would people think if they could see the inside of your heart? And by that I don't mean your pump, your blood pump, but if it was kind of like one of these programs that hackers sometimes will put on a computer where every keystroke gets recorded, so they can follow exactly what you wrote, where you went on the net, what you saw, what you looked at, it's all logged. And it gets sent automatically to the hacker. Of course, the objective usually is to get information, personal information, that benefits the hacker. But what if such a program existed so that every thought that I have, Daryl's looking really fine tonight, boom, there it go, zip, it'd go off. And everybody could read it on a big screen. What if everything you thought, what if all of the thoughts of our hearts, all the imaginations of our minds, were up on the big screen, logged for everybody to read? Kind of scary, huh? Some of you would like to see my log because you'd like to know if I really think all those things that I say about Debbie from the pulpit. That'd be the least of my problems. Hypothetical question? No, not really. Because God's going to bring every secret thing into judgment. He's the one who keeps the log. Every careless word, every impure thought, God knows all of that. It's written in the books, if you'll use the expression that's used in Revelation 20. Books will be opened and we'll be judged according to the things that record what we were doing with our lives. Now, if you knew that everybody would know what you were thinking all the time, would we discipline ourselves more about our thoughts? Oh, I don't need to be thinking that way, because I don't want David to know that that's what I think. Or I don't want Sylvia to know that that's what I think. Or I don't want Eric to know that's what I was thinking or saying. And so I'm going to discipline my thoughts. I'm going to clean up my heart. Just like those Pharisees were all concerned about washing hands. Well, I want to be spotless. So why is it that we don't? Because the fact of the matter is, God does see all that. All of that is transparent to Him. And I believe it's quite possible that on the day of judgment, it'll all be brought out. And you and everybody else will get a chance to see what I was thinking, what I was saying, and what I was doing with my time. Scary thought? That just depends on what you let your heart do. The Pharisees focused on the exterior of man. I believe that Jesus indicated that they needed to think about the condition of their hearts to make sure that their hearts were clean, much more important than clean hands. You know, it's interesting. I guess the last song that we sang, Pure in Heart, it's based on this beatitude from Matthew 5 and verse 8. And the word that's translated pure there, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, is the very same word in the Greek language as that one right there. When Jesus said to the Pharisees, first clean the inside of the cup and plate, that the outside also may be pure, clean. Clean the inside of the cup and plate. That's just the verb form of that word right there. Purify your heart first. The rest of it will take care of itself. Kingdom citizens need to have pure, clean hearts. Now the fact of the matter is, I really need to control my thoughts. I need to discipline the thoughts of my heart, so that I don't defile myself spiritually by the things that come out of my heart, out of my mind. But unfortunately, once I've stained myself with sin, there's nothing I can really do to cleanse that. But the blood of Jesus Christ will do that. I can be washed of all of my sins. I can be cleansed by the blood of Jesus Christ. You know, there's an irony in that. Blood doesn't clean anything, it stains. But in the figure of the Scriptures, blood cleanses me and makes me pure, white as snow. Once again, are you white as snow? Have you been cleansed by the blood of the Lamb? If you need to respond to the gospel this evening, we certainly want to encourage you to come forward to express your faith in Jesus Christ, confess your faith before this audience, and we'll baptize you into Christ so that you can be clean and free from sin. And then join the rest of us, of God's people, who are working to discipline our hearts so that we're not defiled by the things that we think and do. If you need to respond, we invite you as we stand and sing.